My guest today on the Science Studio is Steven Pinker, who's the Johnston Family Professor at Harvard University, who was at MIT before that. He's a well-known cognitive scientist who works in language, and he's perhaps best known for a trilogy of books. The first one, The Language Instinct, second, How the Mind Works, and the third one, which is the reason he's here today, is The Stuff of Thought. Steve, welcome.
Thank you.
As I see you arrive, and I know the punishing tour that you're on, I wonder sometimes why people do this sort of thing. I'm actually going to read you a quote from Ernest Becker. Do you remember who Ernest Becker was? Well-known psychologist.
The Denial of Death?
Yes, The Denial of Death. And Ernest Becker said in front of one of his books, "I have reached far beyond my competence and have probably secured for good a reputation for flamboyant gestures. But the times still crowd me and give me no rest, and I see no way to avoid ambitious synthetic attempts. Either we get some kind of grip on the accumulation of thought, or we continue to wallow helplessly, to starve amidst plenty. So I gamble with science and write."
That's terrific.
What's your reason?
I couldn't have said it better. Well, I enjoy sharing the excitement of the ideas that I work with, that my field has developed. And I do think there is something ennobling about knowledge, in this case, knowledge about ourselves, about our nature. Yeah. I think, as Chekhov said, man will be better when you show him what he is like. And it's thrilling to be part of this collective enterprise of trying to crack the puzzle of how the mind works.
You would now be called, I think you actually have been called, a public intellectual. You're one of the people who communicate. You are the face of one of the people who represent the face of science. There's responsibilities with that. How does that feel? I mean, is this a role that you were looking for? Is this something you sought? Or is this a mantle you bear at this point? I mean, how do you see it?
Well, neither one. I didn't set out trying to be a public intellectual. You can't go to graduate school to become you can't major in being a public intellectual. But I don't find it onerous. I find it flattering that people would be interested in my thoughts or analyses on particular issues. And I try to use it in a way that I think would be enlightening, responsible, getting people to at least see a problem more clearly, whether or not they agree with my particular analysis of the problem.
Just to make sure that we get this on the record, and since you are laboring to persuade people to go and at least acquire a copy of The Stuff of Thought, what's the burden of this particular volume? What's the point, the major thrust of it?
Well, the subtitle is Language as a Window into Human Nature. And I've written books on language. I've written books on human nature. This is the one that uses language as a lens into the brain, in a way. What can we learn about the human concept of space from the way prepositions work? What can we learn about our concept of time from the way tense works? What can we learn about emotion and taboo from swear words? What can we learn about social relationships from innuendo and politeness and other ways in which people don't blurt out what they mean but veil their intentions in doublespeak? These are some of a number of ways in which puzzles of language, I think, force you to understand something about what makes us tick.
Okay. What's your position on language? Do you think that's a uniquely human attribute?
I think the answer to that depends on how you define the word language. But do I think that human language has unique features in the animal kingdom? Yes, I think it does. That is, I think that a lot of very special things happened in the 6 million years since we split off from the common ancestor of chimpanzees. I don't think communication is unique to humans. Clearly it isn't. Animals jabber and call and signal in many ways. But I think grammatical language, that is, conveying a proposition by the way in which you arrange symbols for the concepts that make up that proposition, in such a way that the meaning of the signal depends not just on the elements, but the way they're arranged, and that where there's an open-ended system of giving you an ability to express an unlimited number of ideas, that I think is unique to humans.
When we first talked on television, at least, it's over a decade ago now, we were talking, you just had got the galleys back of the language instinct. So there's obviously a continuity here. The language instinct, could you elaborate what you mean by an instinct?
Yes, well, the title comes from a quote from Charles Darwin. Man has an instinctive tendency to speak, as we see in the babble of our young children, whereas no child has an instinctive tendency to bake, brew, or write. And I think that captured the sense in which language has some evolved innate basis, an idea that's much more closely associated with Noam Chomsky, but that I think Darwin said first. And I think even though, as Darwin himself continued, he called it an instinct to acquire an art, which was mm-hmm. the title of the first chapter, clearly what we inherit is not a particular language or a set of words or constructions, but the ability to combine words according to grammatical rules, I think, is a special feature of the human brain, something that is a product of evolution, even if the content itself has to be filled in by our community.
This is obviously a larger debate, which goes in one extreme, nature versus nurture, one extreme, constructivism, whether you're constructing representations of ideas and so on and so forth, or whether they are innately given, even possibly an expansion of something represented in the genome. I think the details of that would be too complex for us to sort of spend much time on now, and the controversy will range on. But how do you differ from Chomsky on this? I mean, do you actually think there is such a thing as an innate module for language?
I wouldn't call it a module because it is so interwoven with other parts of the mind. Language has to be connected to perceptual faculties so that we can hear and read, to short-term memory so that we can keep in mind how we intend to complete a sentence as we begin it, with social cognition so that we can choose our words to maintain a relationship. Instead of the word module, I like the word a mental organ, which is actually from Chomsky, to give credit where it's due. In the same way that the blood is an organ, even though you can't draw a dotted line around it, and it obviously interacts with many other parts of the body. The word I prefer to modularity is specialization. That is, it's a complex system. It's got parts that work in particular ways to do particular jobs and to talk to one another. The brain is not spam. It's not there's no single principle that governs learning in all domains, I would argue. But that doesn't commit you to a bunch of snap-in modules that don't talk to each other either.
Mm-hmm. But an evolved specialization.
Yeah.
What's the best theory we have at the moment about how such a specialization might have evolved? I mean, what are the
genetic level or the selection pressures? The genetic level, we don't know, although I think we're going to learn, because with the revolution in genomic tools, we'll be able to find genes that have more of an effect on language than on other faculties, and using statistical patterns in the genome, see whether and when selective forces fix those genes in our genome. That's already been done with at least one gene that seems to have a large effect on speech and grammar. In terms of the selective pressures, I think that's much clearer, because we know that any intelligent system benefits from being able to exchange information with other intelligent systems. That's why the internet makes a computer more powerful than if it was just sitting unplugged from the net. We know from simulations that intelligent agents are under a selective pressure to be able to pool information with one another. And we know that humans are unusual, not just in having language, but in two other traits that are also unusual in the animal kingdom and that are exactly what would make language most useful. Number one, we acquire a lot of knowledge about our environment. All human cultures have technologies, tools, intuitive theories about how the local environment works, intuitive biology, where people are acutely aware of the different species that are around them, complex chains of behavior in order to make a living. So we have something to say to one another, namely pooling our hard-won acquired knowledge. And number two, what also makes humans zoologically unusual is the degree of cooperation that we have among non-relatives, where you can't just explain it by kin selection. We exchange things, we cooperate, we exchange favors, and information is an excellent commodity to exchange, because if I tell you how to catch a fish or how to detoxify a plant poison, it's not as if I'm now bereft of the knowledge. Information is a non-rival good. I can share it with you at very little cost to myself. And
literally, talk is cheap.
Talk is cheap. Yeah. And we're on speaking terms, and we have something to say. So I think the triad of language, technological and scientific know-how, and social cooperation were reinforced each other and co-evolved in a kind of a spiral of co-evolution, bringing us to the point we're at today.
Just let's skip back a little bit and find out the trajectory that brought you to this point and working in language. I mean, you were born in...
I was born in Montreal, part of the English-speaking community in Montreal. Grew up there, spent my first 22 years in Montreal, went to McGill University, then went to graduate school at Harvard, and pretty much have spent the rest of my life bouncing back and forth between Harvard and MIT, with interludes at Stanford and sabbaticals at Santa Barbara.
Well, that was a great... Actually, bouncing back and forth is an interesting way of putting it. I mean, there were lots of pieces written about your shift from MIT to your current job at Harvard, where it was talking about poaching you and trophy professors. There was a whole piece you must remember on this. That, yes. In other words, you were valuable goods that were transferred at some point. Do you find it a sort of a strange experience to go through?
I was flabbergasted. It didn't occur to me that anyone would care. But then all of a sudden, I'm reading articles about the fact that I switched jobs. You know, people switch jobs all the time. But there was four or five articles about it. To my shock. Yeah.
How would you characterize the difference between the two places, and why would you shift from one to the other? I mean,
well, I'd been at MIT for 21 years on the faculty and a year as a postdoc, and kind of enough was enough. It's good to be able to put yourself in different environments for the sheer sake of mixing up the sources of stimulation. And I'm extraordinarily lucky. They're both just outstanding institutions in many of the same ways. Their emphasis on excellence and in some different ways. Harvard does many more things than MIT. MIT does a smaller number of things, but does them extraordinarily well.
You're obviously still doing work and publishing papers. I just was looking at a piece the other day that was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, a piece that you'd written with Martin Nowak and James Lee on the logic of indirect speech. Could you gloss that a little bit, just to explain what this is about? Because it sounds very interesting.
Yeah. Well, the phenomenon is the kind of innuendo and politeness and doublespeak that we do all the time, sometimes without even realizing it. So, for example, I say, if you could pass the salt, that would be great. Now, when you think about it, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It wouldn't be great to have the salt, and why not just say, give me the salt? So that's an indirect request. There's the almost cliched sexual come-on, would you like to come up and see my etchings? Mm-hmm. The veiled threat, nice car you got there, would be a real shame if something happened to it. Why don't we just say what we mean? Is the language of politics, of diplomacy, of sex, of fundraising, of bribery, of threats, why is there are these layers of innuendo? And this turns out to be a surprisingly difficult problem. And Martin and James and I argued that the solution requires at least three parts. One of them is the logic of plausible deniability. That is, I don't know when I'm, say, tendering a bribe or making a sexual comment, how my partner's going to react. If let's say I'm bribing a police officer who stopped me for a traffic violation. and I want to offer a bribe. Well, if I offer the bribe in so many words, if I've got a dishonest cop who will take it, I'm in good shape. But if I have an honest cop who arrests me for bribery, I've paid a pretty high price. On the other hand, if I veil it in innuendo, if I say something like, gee, is there any way that we could settle it here without going through all the paperwork and have a $50 bill kind of extending from my wallet, then the dishonest cop can sniff out the bribe behind the innuendo. Mm-hmm. An honest cop couldn't make a bribery charge stick in court by the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So I kind of eat my cake and have it. I aim the level of vagueness in between the threshold for one audience and another audience, where the desired audience can exploit it, the undesired audience cannot. That's, I think, what we mean by plausible deniability. And that's, we present a simple mathematical model as to how that would work. That doesn't solve the problem, though, because we also use indirect speech in everyday life in cases where there's no risk of going to jail. For example, the polite request, if you could pass the salt, that would be great. Or, say, bribing a maitre d' in a restaurant, slipping the maitre d' a $20 bill in exchange for being seated immediately. So what are the costs and benefits there that would push someone to indirect speech, given that they're not in any kind of legal or financial jeopardy? There we have to go to some social and evolutionary psychology on human relationship types. And we tap into a theory from Alan Fisk at UCLA, mm-hmm. tapping a wide, much broader variety of both ethnographic and evolutionary literature on what kind of relationships humans have. And Fisk argues, very interesting way, that humans are always mindful of what kind of relationship they have, and they fall into a small number of kinds, including dominance, reciprocity, and communality, sharing, the kind of sharing that a family or a husband and wife might do, or close friends. And that the reason that we often are tempted toward indirect speech is that some speech acts change the nature of the relationship. You walk into a restaurant, the maitre d' is in an authority relationship. He seats you when and where he pleases. You offer him a bribe, you're changing that. You're saying, we're going to do business instead of you bossing me around. People get very touchy and awkward when it comes to changing a relationship type. So that makes the maitre d' scenario a lot like the cop scenario. Even though you won't go to jail, that feeling of awkwardness of changing the relationship type if the other person wants to keep one relationship and you're suggesting another can duplicate the game theoretic mathematical structure of an overt bribe where there are costs and benefits. And that's the second part of the theory. There's a third part. I don't know if I'm starting to bore the audience there.
The reason I asked about this is that a lot of science these days is actually can be applied to an understanding of what's going on in political systems.
Oh, yes, right.
Language, the way you're dealing with language and the way somebody like, say, George Lakoff would deal with language, although you guys differ, at least begins to make more explicit what is going on in political systems.
Absolutely.
And in candidates. On the other hand, you've got people like Marco Iacoboni or various other cognitive scientists, Drew Weston, mm-hmm. who are looking at brain scans to see if they can try and understand what's a liberal brain look like, what a conservative brain looks like. Some of this stuff is early days and a little worrisome in the enthusiasm which people have embraced it, perhaps. I'm not sure about that. What do you think?
Yeah, I think some of it is in the early stage, and some of the applications I think are often clouded by the fact that the scientist often has such strong political convictions that they, I think, sometimes jigger the science to put their side on the side of the angels and to make their political opponents look like idiots. So I think that's a danger that you have in the application of science to political discourse. But nonetheless, I think it's an important enterprise. It's, I think, an extension of what our best political critics have often done, namely to try to see through the cant and the manipulation so that we can evaluate policies and candidates on their merits. George Orwell being the most famous in terms of analyzing how the political system often perpetrates great crimes and atrocities by the use of euphemism, collateral damage instead of dead civilians, revenue enhancement instead of tax increase, transfer of populations instead of a forced march, 80% of the people dying en route. So that is a tradition where Orwell consulted his own intuitions, and he was, of course, a superb amateur linguist. I think there is great promise in applying everything from linguistics to brain scanning to try to make these techniques more transparent, the better for a democratic populace to see through them.
Yeah, one of the primary functions, as you know, of the Science Network is to try and illuminate areas at the intersection of science and social policy. We've been doing an annual meeting called Beyond Belief. The third one, which is coming up, deals very much with neuroscience, anthropology, and so on, linguistics, and so on. The applications of sciences to politics and to ethics, to law, and so on and so forth. The title of it is actually "Candles in the Dark," which we use as a Science Network brand, if you like, borrowed from Carl Sagan,
yes,
who talked about science as a candle in the dark. And one of the things we're asking people who come to the meeting to do is to suggest pose a problem, something that exercises them at this point, at the intersection of science and social policy, and suggest a possible solution. I know you can't make it this time, but if you were to be there, do you have a candle in the dark?
When it comes to applications, I'm wary of making prescriptions, just because I think you really need a lot of expertise in that particular applied domain before being able to say anything helpful. So, for example, I mean, I do think that there have to be implications of, say, language acquisition, one of my specialties, for the teaching of a foreign language to kids. On the other hand, I haven't spent time in a classroom, I haven't evaluated programs, I haven't designed programs, so the kind of advice that I give would have to be very generic. This is the way to think about it, here are some things to keep in mind, but I would hesitate to say, here's a solution to the problem, being one step more abstract than the actual people in the trenches. And likewise, I can list some areas, social problems, where I think the kind of things that I write about would provide insight to people who are trying to solve the problems without myself feeling confident in offering a solution. So I'll mention some others. Our moral sense, the fact that we humans, I think, are apt to press a moral switch in framing certain problems. And that, I believe, can get in the way of sound policy making. So, for example, in the handling of global warming, perhaps our biggest global challenge. Is it possible that some of the most popular solutions are going to be ineffective just in terms of the sheer atmospheric chemistry, but people are likely to look that way because it makes them feel virtuous? For example, buying carbon offsets when you buy an SUV and you plant a tree. You buy a Prius instead of a Corolla because it saves a couple of miles per gallon. Are those kinds of measures really kind of perhaps even useless? Because in giving people that moral glow, they divert attention from solutions that would have a much bigger quantitative impact on the atmosphere, but might be either be less sexy or might even seem immoral on the face of it, such as atmospheric engineering or increased reliance on nuclear power. Now, I'm not saying that I'm advocating nuclear power as a solution to global warming, but advising people that in evaluating these options, our own moral sense might stack the deck away from the ones that ultimately would lead to the best outcome. So that's a second example. A third example might be education. How can we tap into the child's concept of number, of space in teaching arithmetic and geometry? Another one would be seeing through political discourse. What are the techniques that hide the truth behind euphemism? And is there any way that we can change the political discourse so that politicians are less likely to stick to empty platitudes and more likely to offer specifics without committing suicide at the public stage? Just about any, I would say that just about anything, any study of the human mind has applications, and I could tell you what the areas are without being the doctor that comes in with the cure.
Okay, let's deal with the morality issue, because we do a lot on this sort of stuff. You wrote a cover story for the New York Times
earlier
this year. I don't know whether you came up with the cover line or they did, but it was the moral instinct.
They did. So the editors always choose the titles.
All right. So, and they obviously thought, well, this is nice. Did the language instinct? This is the moral self. Let's do the moral instinct. But that does convey a message, doesn't it? I mean, I looked at it and thought, hello, another module here. Reference to Mark Hauser, talking about a moral grammar, mm-hmm. based analogous to Chomsky's linguistic grammar. And yet, many people would argue that surely morality is not just some sort of given. It's something which you build up through a lifetime of experience, and the different moral codes apply in different places. We'll come back to that in a second. But some of the experiments that have been used, like the notion, you know, the trolley experiments, which is now being called trolleyology.
Yes.
The notion of whether it's appropriate to... why don't you actually describe that problem?
Yes. This is, I think, originally devised by...
Philip Foote, wasn't it?
Philip Foote, yes, that's right. So it's basically trying to... make clear what our intuitions are in cases of utilitarian calculations differing from some instinctive moral tendency. So, classic problem, a trolley is running out of control on a track. Conductor slumped over the controls, dead of a heart attack, is about to slam into five people. You're standing at a switch. You can divert it to a sidetrack. Unfortunately, there's a worker on the sidetrack, and so you, by saving five, you would kill one. Is it permissible to divert the trolley? Most people say yes in pretty much every culture that's been looked at. If you change the terms of the problem in what might seem to be an ethically irrelevant way by saying you're standing on a bridge overlooking the tracks, trolley's out of control, the only way to stop the trolley is by pushing a fat man in the path of the trolley, slowing it down. I saved five people at the cost of killing one. Is that acceptable? And now most people say no. By utilitarian calculus, both involve sacrificing one to save five. Why is there such a strong intuitive difference between the two cases? So that's trolleyology. Right. I think it's part of a much larger set of issues concerning the moral sense. I think probably too much attention has gone to that particular and in some ways artificial problem. Just to get back to your concern on the title, I wouldn't have objected to that title. I think there was, even though I didn't select it, I think there is a set of moral instincts. I don't think it's a single module. And in fact, the main part of the article is that psychologically, what we deem as moral has at least four distinct components, and when cultures vary, they vary not by having arbitrary codes that come out of the blue, but in how much weight they give to each of the four. The four being harm and benefit, that is the kind of fairness of not harming someone unless they deserve it as punishment, and if someone helps you, you owe them help in return. The moralization of hierarchy and autonomy. Many people think that deference to legitimate authority is a moral thing to do. Our celebrity worship, loyalty to country, patriotism. There's an ethic of community, that conforming to social norms and being part of a harmonious community is a moral thing to do. And there's a notion of purity and divinity contrasted with defilement and carnality, closely related to our sense of disgust. We equate what's disgusting with what's immoral and what is clean and pure with what's morally praiseworthy. This owes a lot to Jonathan Haidt and to Richard Schwader and Paul Rozin, mm-hmm. To again give credit where it's due. The idea that there are different psychological components to the moral sense, I think gets around the problem that on the one hand there is something very peculiar about morality. It's not just something that you could pick up by interacting with things or people in the world. You don't have to have morality, and moral reasoning has a number of inexplicable quirks, such as the contrasting intuitions in the trolley problem. And we know that morality is something you find in all human cultures. We know there's a small fraction of people, psychopaths, who seem to be lacking a moral sense. So on the one hand, there is evidence for universality. On the other hand, there is cultural variation. But I think you can reconcile those two observations by noting that there are these different components that can be emphasized or suppressed. Ours is a culture where fairness and harm dominate the other spheres. In more traditional societies, fairness takes a back seat to deference to authority and respect for community, for example. But it's very much analogous to language, where if anything is innate to language, it certainly can't be the English language or the Japanese language, but it could be a system for a combinatorial system.
Sure. Again, what worries me about some of this stuff, in the same way as one taking initial brain scans and making a large story out of them, what worries me about this is that, as you just said, that the trolleyology thing has become the focal centre of all of this and has become the test case. And as you're probably well aware, there's a lot of people have been sort of working on that. David Pizarro at Cornell, in fact, has shown that if you change the context of that and put African American people onto the trolley or vice versa, then the whole experiment changes. So it does seem to be context dependent to some extent, and that's why I was raising the issue about how one could think of there being something so concise, as an instinct or as a module for that, when in fact it seems to be developed through one's life experiences, one's experience of status and relationships, and so on and so forth. And
well, those aren't contradictory.
No, they not be.
I don't know about this Pizarro experiment, but certainly the contrast between the two paradigm cases is a very empirically robust phenomenon, right. And is found in pretty much the same proportions in every culture that's been tested. But of course, it is such sensitive to context, which is why there's a kind of science of trolleyology, in the sense that that's how you probe the moral sense, by seeing how variables such as how direct is the causation, how intended, how foreseen is there, is the harm a means to an end, or is it an undesired byproduct? It's the context sensitivity, the sensitivity to those variables, that makes it a useful research tool.
I think the jury's obviously out on this, and we spend a lot of time at these meetings discussing this precise issue because it seems to me to be elemental and very important. And I suppose the good point to take from this is that there is now beginning to be the beginnings of a science of morality, which I think is
a science
important.
Of moral sense, which
science
I would distinguish
moral
from
sense.
Morality.
Okay, science yes. of moral sense. I take the correction.
Yes.
If you had asked me a few months ago what Steven Pinker's next book was going to be, and I didn't know, I'd have said, "Oh, he's doing the moral instinct." Must be the next book. But I see that, in fact, if I'd thought a little harder and looked around a little bit, I would have found that, it, in fact, it's not going to be that. What I have here, in fact, is one of the Edge annual questions that John Brockman's group puts together. This is the volume, What Are You Optimistic About? And I notice in here that you were optimistic about the decline of violence. And you also wrote a piece for The New Republic, arguing that we're getting nicer every day, was, again, some editor's line, I suppose.
Yes.
But you're talking about a history of violence here, and you're arguing that, in fact, things are improving. How on earth do you read the newspapers?
Yes, well, I do read the newspapers, but remember, the newspapers just tell you what the rate is now. And it's true, the rate of violence is not zero. But the claim isn't that violence has vanished. The claim is it was even worse a while ago. And in fact, a lot of the evidence is all around us, but but I think there is a cognitive bias to think that the present is more violent than the past. In fact, I've done experiments to show this, that people are systematically incorrect in judging rates of violence in different eras. So here's some qualitative things. Just, you don't even have to look at numbers or graphs. But over the last millennium, say, in certainly in Western societies and to a lesser extent in others, we've gotten rid of human sacrifice, of slavery, of torture as criminal punishment, mutilation as criminal punishment.
Mostly, I mean.
Oh, mostly in the sense that, say, waterboarding.
Torture's been raised, I mean, that's.
Well, there's a big difference between, for one thing, waterboarding and, say, crucifixion.
Yeah.
Yes. There's also a difference between. I mean, I'm opposed to waterboarding of terrorist suspects. I got to add this, but it's still different when it's used as a technique to extract information than when it's used as a form of criminal punishment. And if you look at the Middle Ages, where there were a huge list of capital crimes, like, you know, criticizing the king or heresies of all kinds of ridiculous sorts, and the punishments would be things like breaking on the wheel and burning on the stake, and ones that are just too horrible to mention because I don't want to give viewers nightmares. I got nightmares when I started reading about these torture techniques, and they're gone. And as deplorable as it is that suspects are being tortured in Guantanamo, there's no comparison. Quantitatively, qualitatively. Slavery. The number of corporal punishment as part of the criminal justice system, things like stocks, branding, mutilation. So those are all qualitative things. You can look in the history books and see when they were abolished. Then there are a lot of quantitative things, too, that people don't appreciate, such as homicide rates have gone down in Western countries by a factor of 10 to 50 since the Middle Ages. That's something that that you can actually tally, because a lot of towns in the Middle Ages, starting in the Middle Ages, kept pretty good cause of death records. And criminologists have a consensus that there's been a massive reduction in homicide in over the last few centuries. War since the Second World War. Rates of war have plummeted, so that war between developed industrialized countries are basically zero. And other forms of war, although they peaked in the 70s, have also been in decline. Entertainment. We no longer torture animals as a form of entertainment. There's a long list of ways that people don't realize it until you present it to them, of how, in many ways, the old idea of the rise from savagery and barbarism may have had something to it. The question is, what is it about our sensibilities, our foresight, our empathy, our knowledge, that allows us to repress these violent tendencies, which you do see popping up when they're not repressed? And so as a psychologist, I find this an intriguing problem. It's a nice, for someone who believes that there is such a thing as human nature, as I do, it's a nice kind of challenge as to how behavior can change, even if there's something about our nature that hasn't changed. What is the dimension of variation? Is it that our sense of empathy can expand to encompass greater proportions of the Earth's population? And if so, what drives our empathy circle outward? Is it that the functions of the prefrontal cortex of inhibiting behavior and counting to 10 before you wallop someone, anticipating the consequences of committing violence, kick in? And if so, why are we better at using our frontal lobes than our ancestors of a millennium ago were?
There's six directions I want to go in now, which is one of the fun things about talking with somebody who ranges so widely. It's also a constraint. Let me take one position there, which is that we talk a lot at some of these meetings about issues like religion, faith, belief. You grew up in Montreal from a Jewish background, right? Plainly, that's, I don't know to what extent you're still involved in that. I mean, I noticed that in the dedication to the Stuff of Thought, which is dedicated to Rebecca Goldstein, Rebecca Neuberger-Goldstein, as I should know, having had her beyond belief last year, and she read wonderfully from a novel she was working on. You say that you describe her as my Bashert, to whom this book is dedicated. I gather that means soulmate, and I gather that...
Yes, well, it's Yiddish for... It's kind of more like a destined. Yes.
And I gather that you actually now are married.
Yes, that's right. Well, we like to say we eloped, but the cat is out of the bag.
The cat is out of the bag. Well, to what extent, in dealing with these sorts of issues, does having come from a Jewish background colour the way you think?
Well, I think I didn't have my religious background was mostly cultural, not theological. I don't think the word God was ever mentioned in my household. I went to Sunday school, and there wasn't a whole lot of God talk there. It was there was a lot of arguing, and Jews are famous for being opinionated. There's the old expression, 10 Jews, 11 opinions. And so that tradition, perhaps handed down from Talmudic disputation, was very much part of my Jewish education. Maybe it's part of my personality. I'm very happy to acknowledge the influence of Jewish culture on my own thinking and personality. But for me, it's a cultural endowment and gift. It's something that I have a great deal of affection for. I think in the way that, say, an Italian American would have great affection for everything Italian. It is certainly not theological, and nor is it. That is, I'm an atheist. So the advantage of being Jewish is that there's. It's kind of a don't ask, don't tell kind of religion, where as long as you do the right things, no one cares that much what you think. And of course, I don't do them either in terms of being religiously observant. But I do mind the cultural tradition for the humor, the language, the tradition of intellectual disputation. I also don't, I used to think, and this was very much part of my background, that that Judaism was the original source of morality in the Western tradition, that the Jews gave morality to the world in the form of the Torah and the Ten Commandments and so on. And I don't believe that anymore. I mean, I don't think there's anything, I don't think the Jews have been immoral, but I think that the source of morality goes back to the Greeks and was really developed in the Enlightenment, and that the Bible is a pretty rotten guide to how we should treat each other.
Again, six directions to go there. But because you've actually written about this, there's an additional point I want to raise here, which is that you've written about why is there such a preponderance of intellectual brilliance in such a small community, and how could that possibly have arisen? And you've written on this. Would you like to sort of scout the argument a little bit for me?
Yes. Well, I was writing, explaining a proposal by a geneticist and an anthropologist, Henry Harpending and Gregory Cochran, where they argued that it's not Jewish mothers, it's Jewish genes, and a very controversial hypothesis that selection for the middleman niche in medieval and early modern Europe, that is, merchants, retailers, moneylenders, involved Darwinian natural selection on genes that enhanced abstract intellectual reasoning, that it's more intellectually demanding to be a moneylender or a merchant than it is to be a farmer or a soldier or a craftsperson. And that as a result, there was a millennium or so of selection and the outsized representation of Ashkenazi Jews in intellectually demanding professions and pastimes, like chess, is a product of that. I didn't endorse that hypothesis. I don't know if it's true. We don't have enough evidence to believe it. But what I did do is try to explain it, including the empirical tests that would show whether it's true or false, which Cochran and Harpending explained themselves. They also argued that the genetic disease load in Ashkenazi Jews, something that's long been documented, the fact that Jews are more susceptible to a variety of genetic diseases like Tay-Sachs, is a byproduct of selection of genes for rapid brain development. And that's what makes the hypothesis testable. And the test is actually quite straightforward. If you were to look at the intelligence of carriers of a single copy of recessive disease-causing genes characteristic of the Ashkenazim, they should be smarter. And that, if anyone wanted to do the experiment, that would test it.
Hmm. Henry Harpending, implicit in what you were just saying, and also in other papers that Henry published last year, is that human evolution is still going on, and at a fairly amazing clip, according to him. If that's the case, I have to ask you about this, because you from evolutionary psychology position and so on, the idea is that there is a human nature and that we, in fact, basically have inherited a great number of adaptations which were useful to us in our days as hunter-gatherers. We still have them and so on and so forth. Does that jibe with Henry's notion of things changing so rapidly, selective pressures producing so many differences? Wouldn't there be cognitive differences happening now? Wouldn't all our hunter-gatherer instincts have gone away and so on? Wouldn't we have a new set of instincts? Wouldn't we be remaking ourselves as we go along?
That's quite possible. I mean, in a sense, it would be, on the one hand, it would complicate one of the simplifying assumptions of evolutionary psychology, which is that so much more of human evolution took place in the hunter-gatherer stage than in the agricultural or industrial stages, that most of human nature would be weighted to the hunter-gatherer lifestyle. So that has to be modified depending on what the evidence looks like in terms of what proportion of our genes have been targets of recent selection, and of course what those genes do. They may just be disease resistance genes. On the other hand, in a way, if he's right, and if those if there has been a lot of recent selection, and if it turns out that those genes involve cognition and emotion, it would kind of be evolutionary psychology on steroids, in the sense that it wouldn't just be that we're adapted to that particular environment, but that we may have adaptations to much more recent features of our ecology. So I think that certainly will require changes in the simplifying assumption of evolutionary psychology, but it's too early to tell what they'll be.
So one of the other pieces that bears on this is another Brockman thing. What is your dangerous idea? And your dangerous idea was groups of people may differ genetically in their average talents and temperaments. Is this essentially what we've been talking about here?
Well, it's related to that, in the sense that if all human evolution stopped before the ancestral populations split off and went to their different continents, then it would be almost impossible for there to be innate differences between groups. If evolution has continued since after that split, then at least it's possible. Now, it doesn't mean that it happened, and if it did happen, it doesn't mean that it happened in different ways in the different branches. It could be that this whatever selection has taken place recently has happened in every branch of the human lineage. So one doesn't imply the other, but it does open the door to it.
And you also said at the beginning here, because you wrote the introduction to this, and I thought it was rather nice, that it was a piece about the importance of science in boldly facing and coming up with these dangerous ideas, and that the science has this immensely important role to play. This goes back to the point I raised earlier about your being a kind of a statesman of science at this point. How do you see, given the fact that we have an election coming up not too far away, what do you see the role of science in future administrations? Do you think that there's enough emphasis on science? Do you think it's been given short shrift?
I think it has been given short shrift. I'm one of the advocates of Science Debate 08.
We will have some of those people coming to Beyond Belief. So
very good, yes. The idea that the presidential candidates should have one debate on science and technology. I was originally skeptical of the idea that there was a Republican war on science, to quote Chris from Chris Mooney's book. But I think there's a lot, unfortunately, there's been a lot to that, that there's been a suppression and a hostility of science in the last 8 years, and which I dearly hope will be reversed. For one thing, we have to have a grip on reality. If climate change is happening, we better do something about it. We have to know what the facts are. I think there's enormous potential for mitigation of human misery in biomedical research. If we've got a bioethics council that's trying to say that every advance in genetics is going to lead to brave new world based on pure science fiction dystopia, then I think that has enormous potential for increasing human suffering.
The President's Council on Bioethics just produced a report on which was entitled Human Dignity, a concept which they were unable to define and had great problems with, and you wrote a piece about that in which you said...
Dignity is a useless concept when it comes to above and beyond human rights or human autonomy. That is, if you prevent people from harming others or constraining their freedom, then you have everything that you need in a bioethics, and this additional concept of human dignity adds nothing. Let me be concrete. What are we talking about? Imagine that you had some procedure that made people happier and healthier. Let's say people could get compensated for organ donation. More people donate kidneys. More people who die waiting for a kidney would have their lives saved. What's not to like? Well, the argument is that compromises human dignity. If you put money in someone's retirement account for donating a kidney, you're making it a commodity, and that insults human dignity, and so we shouldn't allow it. I say, if the price that you're paying is tens of thousands of people dying needlessly, then dignity is not doing any moral good. In fact, it's doing moral harm. Likewise, if there is a research on embryonic stem cells, if that has the potential to make human lives longer and happier and healthier at the cost of some nebulous notion of human dignity being compromised, then so much the worse for the concept of dignity. We don't need it.
But there's so many people in that report obviously were deeply concerned about this as a concept. There has to be, let's just dig it a little bit deeper. I mean, there has to be something there that means something to people, even if it's a kind of a folk psychological term that hasn't been properly understood and hasn't been unpacked properly. Plainly, if people say things like that they would like to die with dignity, there's something meant
by that.
Oh, yes.
Okay, yes. No, that absolutely. And, of course, note what you're doing there. You're respecting people's wishes. And so it boils down to what other bioethicists sometimes call autonomy or rights. Namely, people have the right to live the lives they want as long as they're not harming someone else. So dignity is something that each one of us values for ourselves. And to that extent, it ought to be respected just as all our other interests ought to be respected. Dignity is also something that we should cultivate in the sense of making it harder for people to be tempted to harm one another and more likely to respect one another. So as a good emotional reaction, it's something that we should foster. But when it's brought in this very abstract way to outlaw procedures that actually save lives, that actually cure diseases, then I think it's an abuse of dignity, that we use it in cases where it's something that people want to preserve for themselves. And when people voluntarily relinquish dignity in search of some higher good, like not dying, then I think we should respect that. The case of the compensated kidney donor perhaps being the clearest.
Values often formed in the home, going back to Montreal and your family. Your parents were any science background here at all?
Not a science background. My mother was a guidance counselor, then a vice principal. My father did various things, including real estate and law and sales. But there was certainly an encouragement of science, especially if it would involve some connection to medicine. But
my son, the doctor,
exactly. But more than that, there was an interest in from both of my parents in science, and there still is. I'm fortunate they're both alive and healthy. My parents bought me when I was 12 years old, the Time Life Science series. Every month, a volume would come in on a different topic. Mm-hmm. And I certainly owe my interest in the mind to the fact that one of those volumes was called The Mind. Right. So there was an encouragement, but they weren't themselves scientists.
Okay. Sisters, brothers?
Brother is a policy analyst for the Canadian government, and my sister is a journalist and author. She herself has a book on sex differences called The Sexual Paradox, based scientific literature and her own experience as a child psychologist.
Sexual differences, male-female differences, cognitive differences, some alleged, different way in which males and females are treated in schools, should there be single-sex schools, that entire debate, that's something you've been involved in, of course. You were at Harvard and defended Larry Summers, who made an unfortunate remark which seemed to imply that he was sexist. Perhaps you'd like to sort of remind us of that.
Yes, that's Larry Summers, in looking at the causes of a very narrow phenomenon, namely, why is the ratio of tenured faculty at elite universities in science, engineering, and math not 50-50? And one possibility is that it's because women are discouraged from and their barriers and biases. And that's generally the only one that you're allowed to talk about. If you open up the pages of Science Magazine or look at a report from the National Academy, that's the only thing that's mentioned. And Larry said, well, as any labor economist knows, that you can't take unequal outcomes as proof of discrimination, because there may be differences in lifestyle preferences. People choose different jobs depending on the exact mix of money, hours, social interaction, intellectual stimulation. There may be statistical differences in mixtures of abilities that, when you look at the extreme tail, will lead to a statistical imbalance. If, on average, men are more likely to be found at the extremes of the distribution, that is, they're more retarded boys than retarded girls, but maybe more math freaks among boys than among girls. Even if it's a small statistical difference, when you get out to several standard deviations beyond the mean, then it will be noticeable in statistics like how many math professors of each gender are there at MIT. The argument was I think, statistically quite sophisticated. Larry Summers, of course, being a brilliant economist. Similar to arguments that I made in the blank slate, but through a series of I think tragedies and blunders, part of it being the political correctness of academia, part of it being some, I think, bad decisions that Summers himself made as this unfolded, it blew up to a kind of academic political crisis. A lot of the statements got distorted, such as women can't do math, which is just, you know, only a madman could believe that. It's what I thought was sad was that a teachable moment had passed. Namely, how do we deal with the possibility that there are statistical differences between groups of people in a way that preserves our commitment to fairness and equality? By the way, it's part of the argument also, of course, is that women are overrepresented in other areas of academia. In my own field, language development in children, it's probably 3-to-1 female biased.
Yeah. That was an interesting phrase that you used there, and it seems to me that I wonder if I'm putting words in your mouth, that this is one of the things that you do in response to my reading the Ernest Becker quote, is that you do spend a lot of time enlarging and elaborating on teachable moments. And that seems to be your trade, if I could put it that way.
In terms of the so-called public intellectual side, yeah. That's right. Often, and it's often just because of the dynamics of publishing, namely, editors like some news hook when they assign a piece, and when I hear one that's a good opportunity to explain some cognitive science, that's when I will jump in.
I made a slight error earlier when I said that this was the third book in the trilogy. I sort of forgot the blank slate for a moment there. So it was really Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, Blank Slate.
And then there's my book on irregular verbs.
Words and book on irregular verbs, which
my little friends.
Just sort of leaps off the shelves.
Yeah, right.
And then the stuff of thought, right? If you had not been a scientist, what would you have liked to have been?
Certainly some kind of educator. I think at one point I wanted to be a math teacher. I also fantasized at one point about being a computer programmer, but I think that would not have been as fulfilling a career.
You must be very diligent at this computer. I mean, I asked you years ago, how on earth do you manage to assemble all this information? Because the books are absolutely full of information. There's cartoons. Do you have a staff of people finding cartoons for you and jokes?
No, I don't. But like many people now, I get them involuntarily by email. I save the ones I like. I read the comic pages in the Boston Globe. I have both physical files of clippings, and I read newspaper and magazine with the scissors. Nowadays, of course, more and more of it is electronic, and I have directories in my computer in which I store links or articles that are relevant to language or to evolution or to brain science or genetics.
How do you write?
I like to write intensely. I like to cordon off blocks of time in which I write morning, noon, and night, day after day, taking out a couple of hours for exercise and socializing and discussion. But a good day for me when I'm writing is to wake up and write and then go cycling or jogging before dinner and then get back to work after dinner and then do the same thing the next day.
So you're not an owl or a lark. You don't work better at night or in the morning?
No, that's right.
Grind away all day long.
I grind away all day long, and I think one of the reasons I like that is because the image that keeps coming to mind is the juggler with the balls. Once they're in the air, it's easy to keep them in the air. The hard part is getting them in the air in the first place. And when I'm trying to connect a lot of ideas, to have them at my fingertips, both in my own mental space, but also even physically, to have all my books and papers in front of me. For an extended period of time, and I know that that's the book in that stack that has that quote or that graph, that makes it easier.
We're actually sitting in what used to be the study of Francis Crick, the late Francis Crick.
Is that right?
Window here, you see there's a double helix up there. Francis Crick, of course, was co-discoverer of DNA, and some people would regard him as the most eminent biologist of the 20th century. As you know, when Francis came to the Salk Institute, he then shifted from biology to neuroscience, essentially taught himself neuroscience, became immensely interested in consciousness.
Yes.
That's another of the areas that you work in. You have some thoughts on free will and so on, and on consciousness. These are, again, issues that come up in all the things we've been talking about, morality, religion, belief, and so on, and are being explored by scientists. Now, what's your current position on this?
Yes. Well, I share Francis's excitement. He was the one responsible for making it exciting, that consciousness has become a topic in cognitive neuroscience, and that we're understanding more and more about the neural correlates of consciousness, NCC, I think he coined that acronym.
With Christoph Koch.
With Christoph Koch. I think I have a lot of respect for their theory of what underlies consciousness. I also think that there is a little nugget, a little kernel of the problem that may not be a scientific problem, the so-called hard problem of consciousness, a nice term from David Chalmers, but one that, of course, goes back to Descartes and before, namely that there's still a gap, and there may always be a gap as to, even after we've identified down to the last neural firing, what goes on in the brain when someone is consciousness, why it actually feels like something to be that brain, may be a puzzle that that will stay with us. That's where I would place my bet. And in that regard, I've allied myself with a tradition of people, most recently Colin McGinn, but before that Thomas Nagel, David Hume, Noam Chomsky, Gunther Stent, the biochemist, and others, who have suggested that there are some puzzles that might stay with us simply because our minds are structured in a way that they can't wrap themselves around them. And the so-called hard problem of consciousness might be one of them. Although this is, the hard problem of consciousness may not be a problem. Dan Dennett famously doesn't believe there is such a problem. I think is preposterous, but he thinks it's preposterous that I think that there is such a problem. And it says nothing about progress ever stopping in terms of the so-called easy problem of consciousness, Francis's problem, the neural correlates of consciousness. There, it's a tremendously exciting field, and I think it's going to, I think we can expect a complete solution.
Dan would say that you had to have language to qualify as conscious as well, right?
In one sense, yes, and I would not agree with that. I mean, as much as I'm devoted my life to understanding language, I tend to think it gets overrated, that too much is attributed to language. That I think there's lots of consciousness that goes on without language.
You have the whole of history to work with. Who would you have liked to have sat down and had a conversation with?
Probably David Hume, in terms of Thomas and Thomas Hobbes. I think those would be the first two on my list, perhaps. I mean, Charles Darwin, but everyone's going to say Charles Darwin. But Hume had the kind of mind where there wasn't a single topic that he thought about that he didn't have something interesting to say. And also strikes me as being a kind of a bon vivant, a wit, and just interesting person to bounce ideas off. And Hobbes also. Hobbes, like Darwin and Orwell, contributed his name to something very nasty. I mean, Orwellian and Darwinian and Hobbesian. But nonetheless, all three of them were brilliant and quite morally sophisticated men. And Hobbes anticipated a lot of what we now call cognitive science, the idea that the mind is a mechanism. That was not obvious in the 17th century, and he was uncompromising about it. I also think his analysis of violence was way ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. And what we remember is the meme, life in a state of nature is nasty, brutish, and short, which seems to imply that he thought that we had this irrational thirst for blood. But he actually analyzed the dynamics of violence in a way that we would now call game theoretic, where he showed that some aspects of violence are what you would expect given rational agents in any kind of competition. So I think both his analysis of cognition and his analysis of violence made him well ahead of his time, and I would love to confront him with what we now know and get his take on it.
Interesting. Darwin, you mentioned this. Obviously, we're coming up to Darwin at 200. February the 12th, 2009, will be Darwin's bicentennial. Also, Abraham Lincoln the same day.
Oh, yes, and the sesquicentennial of The Origin.
Right, is coming up on November the 24th, publication of The Origin. We'll be doing something about Darwin on the Science Network on a regular basis. Perhaps you could. Do you have a my Darwin, my thoughts about Darwin, what Darwin means to me sentiment here?
Yeah. I mean, what Darwin did, and here I'm borrowing in part from Dan Dennett, is he unified the world of life and ultimately of mind with the world of physics and chemistry. So he built the most important bridge in the great continuum of human knowledge, and showing that complex life, adaptation, diversity of life needn't be attributed to a miracle, but it's intelligible based on physical causation.
And you'd have liked to have had dinner with Darwin as well.
Well, Darwin, as well as being a really nice guy from all accounts, but he truly did have an extraordinary mind. The idea that was popular for a while that he was a kind of dullard who counted barnacles and stumbled upon this theory, obviously wrong. He's an extraordinary mind. You can see that by looking at some of his lesser-known works, such as The Expression of the Emotions in Animals and Man, a book whose reissue I reviewed for Nature a few years ago, with enormous subtlety and sophistication of observation. And he made these amazing empirical predictions that people don't often call attention to. So at the end of The Origin, he said, well, nothing that I've said so far can answer the question of whether life originated once or more than once. So it's possible that animals and plants were independent. But I know I've been told that certain chemical irritants can cause tumors to form on animals and galls to form on plants. That leads me to think that there may be a chemical commonality beneath all that diversity. Man, what a prescient prediction. And here's another one. When the first human fossils are found, they'll be found in pre-human fossils, hominid fossils. They'll be found in Africa. How did he know that? Because that's where the chimps are. And chimps and humans are morphologically the most similar. So those are just two observations, not the most famous ones that Darwin has made, but that lead me to think that, yes, he'd be a hell of a dinner companion.
Yeah. A very smart guy as well. Here's a question. Who would be the wisest person you know? Who would be the smartest person you know? Who's the smartest person first?
Oh, dear. Having spent my life in these wonderful institutions, I've met so many smart people. The smartest. Oh, there are too many, and I don't want to make too many enemies. And the wisest. I better not.
Okay. Is there a question that you would have liked to have answered that people have so far failed to ask you? What would that be? Is there some question that you would really
like... one has ever asked?
Yeah, that you would really like to expound on. Nobody's ever got around to it.
Lots. How does the brain represent a proposition, an idea that can be true or false? I think that's at the core of the bridge between neuroscience and cognitive science, and I think it's still an unsolved problem. I think our neural network models can account for a lot of phenomena, but I don't think that capturing the meaning of a sentence is something that we have a good neural model for now. That would be one. What were the evolutionary precursors to language? What did the hominids who used language before our species sound like? Why do we enjoy music? Does it have an adaptive function? I'm skeptical that it does. If not, is it a byproduct of some quirk of our neural wiring? And if so, what is it?
Because you did refer to it as
auditory cheesecake.
Auditory cheesecake, yes. Yeah.
And it's one area where everyone wants it to be. At the same time as people are often very critical of evolutionary psychology for saying that certain things like a moral sense are an adaptation, everyone wants music to be an adaptation. And so I get it from both sides.
I think we'll actually do a meeting on music at some point, and we'll have Dan Levitin in, and you can come and argue with him, and we'll all have a nice conversation about it. Is there any discovery that you wish you could have made?
Oh. Huh. Boy, where would I begin?
Oh, just a lot.
A lot. Oh, yeah. To be there at the moment. Well, certainly, the discovery of the structure of DNA certainly would be up there. Mm-hmm. Hubel and Wiesel's discovery of feature-sensitive cells in the visual cortex. George Miller's discovery of top-down influences on speech perception. Even Noam Chomsky's first mathematical analyses of language, showing the elegant mathematical structure of simple phrases. Well, those are a few.
We usually end on with this question about what are you optimistic about. In a sense, we've dealt with that earlier because it's apparently the subject of your next book. But let me just try it again anyway. What are you optimistic about, given the state of society at the moment?
That the processes of enlightenment and reason will continue to drive violence down. That some of the events that we've enjoyed in our lifetimes that were almost unthinkable beforehand, the fall of the Soviet Empire, the end of apartheid, the fact that the Cold War ended without the use of nuclear weapons, if you would have said any of these things, the fact that Israel and Egypt are at peace, the fact that the homicide rate has plummeted since the 1990s in the United States, if you would have made any of those predictions in 1975 or 1985, people would have said, what are you smoking? But they all came true. My hope is that an ability to see the future, to think about our predicament, to see our predicament as a problem that can be solved, will lead to more pleasant surprises like that.
Steven Pinker, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.